The immediate issue is to prove, that one country, two systems works well in Hong Kong.
Thousands in Hong Kong show their disagreement with their government leader. This is Wednesday, June 10th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, as George Floyd is buried, protests continue in the U.S. over his death. You'll hear from an author who has written about racial discrimination in the United States throughout the years. Australian officials claim massive security hacks among the people of that country. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Riot police officers charged at thousands of protesters who defied a police ban to mark the first anniversary of the city's anti-government movement Tuesday night. People began gathering at the downtown Chatter Garden in the business district of Central in the late afternoon. Some held up banners saying Hong Kong independence and shouting slogans. Dozens of riot police descended on them and conducted body searches on many. They ordered crowds to leave, saying they were taking part in an unapproved gathering and would arrest them if they did not abide. A man who swore at police officers was swiftly detained while crowds chanted anti-police slogans. Later, protesters spilled onto streets and merged with a crowd that was leaving work in the financial district. People formed a line and started marching as they chanted slogans, held up torchlights on their mobile phones, and waved banners mostly emblazoned with messages demanding independence from China. Many also put up umbrellas in case police fired tear gas. Supporters of the movement say their feelings on the anniversary range from hope to fear. More from Reuters' Amber McCarthy.
This high school student says his dream is for the Chinese Communist Party to let go and give back a free Hong Kong. The protests succeeded in forcing a backdown by the Hong Kong government on proposed legislation that would have allowed extradition to mainland China. But a year later, authorities in Beijing are drafting national security laws that activists fear would further curb freedoms.
We feel that our freedom is being ignored, and we can't stand out to fight, even we have a low right to assemble. So we're feeling helpless.
Demonstrations over the past year often turned violent, with police responding with tear gas and rubber bullets. The protests have strong support among Hong Kong's 7.5 million people, according to opinion polls, with about one-third of the population opposed. And protesters aren't giving up hope.
Hong Kong people are always strong. That's what I think. They never feel tired, or even for working, they can work overtime. Their desire is very strong. And I think I can see some international or some other countries are still supporting us. So we will try to use our wisdom to find some other way to continue our fight.
That was Reuters' Emmer McCarthy reporting. City leader Carrie Lam, an unpopular pro-Beijing appointee, was peppered with questions from reporters Tuesday about the unrest under her tenure. Hong Kong cannot afford such chaos, she said, adding all sides needed to learn lessons.
The immediate issue is to prove, that one country, two systems works well in Hong Kong, and to prove that Hong Kong people are reasonable and sensible citizens of the People's Republic of China, that we could be trusted to continue to have our own way of life and our own way of system within the whole country.
Some of the protesters on the streets of Hong Kong held placards reading, "We Can't Breathe, Free HK, and Young Lives Matter," nods to U.S. protest against police brutality sparked by the death of African-American George Floyd. More on that coming up. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. A study by U.S. researchers suggests the novel coronavirus that was first detected in central China may have begun spreading well before the outbreak was first revealed to the world. A South Korean court rejects an arrest warrant for the heir to the legendary Samsung Group's conglomerate. New Zealanders gather at restaurants and cafes to celebrate the official end of their long coronavirus quarantine period. A Reuters report says a little-known Indian IT firm offered its hacking services to help clients spy on more than 10,000 email accounts over a period of 7 years. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. In the states of Texas and North Carolina, hundreds gathered to say their final goodbyes to George Floyd, a man who died after being in police custody in the state of Minnesota. While in Washington, D.C., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi introduced sweeping legislation to combat police violence and racial injustice. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more.
We are here to honor George Floyd.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi led House and Senate Democrats in a moment of silence at the Capitol's Emancipation Hall. They took a knee for nearly 9 minutes to symbolize the length of time prosecutors say George Floyd, handcuffed and face down, was pinned under a white police officer's knee before he was later pronounced dead at a Minnesota hospital. Floyd's death sparked worldwide protest against police brutality and racial injustice. Over the weekend, thousands more continued to protest. Floyd's death also prompted the National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell to say that the league was wrong for not listening earlier to players fighting for racial equality.
We, the National Football League, believe Black Lives Matter. I personally protest with you and want to be part of the much-needed change in this country. Without Black players, there would be no National Football League. And the protests around the country are emblematic of the centuries of silence, inequality, and oppression of Black players, coaches, fans, and staff.
Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, Floyd's girlfriend and others gathered at a park on Saturday to remember Floyd and release balloons to honor lives lost at the hands of law enforcement.
Floyd is here with us. He loves us. And I've been wanting for a long time, and whatever religion you are, however you pray, I've been wanting to thank Father God and be with a group of people that love him and support us and just thank Father God. Thank you, Father God, for giving us Floyd.
Floyd was also remembered in his North Carolina hometown by mourners who waited hours for a glimpse of his golden coffin. And in Houston, Texas, the final of a series of memorials in Floyd's honor, the public was able to view his casket at the Fountain of Praise Church. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Malaysia will ask Bangladesh to take back about 300 Rohingya refugees detained after a boat carrying them entered its waters this week. That according to the Southeast Asian nation's defense minister. Malaysia does not recognize refugee status, but has been a favored destination for ethnic Rohingya. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Not since the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s has the United States witnessed such an outcry for racial equality. Many of those protesting say the death of George Floyd was the breaking point in a long list of African-American deaths at the hands of police, as well as 400 years of racial inequality. VOA's Lori London spoke with Karen Gray Houston, journalist and author of the book Daughter of the Boycott.
My book starts with a case of white police brutality. There was a man named Hilliard Brooks who was a friend of my father's, and like my dad, was also a World War II veteran. And he tried to get a ride on a bus in downtown Montgomery back in 1950. Police officer was called because he had been acting drunk and disorderly. However, when the police officer arrived, he took out a gun and he shot and killed that person. This is how it differs from how people are responding now. My father and an AMVETS commander at the school where they were teaching veterans, a Catholic, black Catholic school, decided to write a letter to city officials, to the mayor and to the police chief, and say, we want that police officer prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Well, that didn't happen. A white police review board found that it was a justifiable shooting. And so my dad and this other gentleman, they organized a massive march of veterans downtown in Montgomery, a march with a purpose. They carried signs that said ballots will beat bullets, and they marched to the courthouse where people could register to vote. So it was really a very peaceful way of handling a very bad situation. This was 5 years before Martin Luther King actually even got involved and started talking about nonviolent civil disobedience. And back to that case, the marchers had an encounter with police, but it was a very peaceful one. A sheriff's deputy came over and said, hey, you guys have to put those signs down. And they basically agreed to put the signs down, but they didn't stop marching. Mm-hmm. And so there was none of the violence. There wasn't any looting. There wasn't any burning. Nobody vandalized anything. What happened with that case of white police brutality was in keeping with the same kind of philosophy that Dr. King was preaching during the boycott, which happened 5 years later. Nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is so deeply embedded into your life as a journalist. Were you shocked to see all of the fires and looting and violence and destruction this time around?
We have never seen anything like this before, but we've seen a cycle of excessive force by white officers against unarmed black men that, for whatever reason, continues to happen. As I was working on the book, doing my research, in 2015, there was a whole rash of police brutality cases. I can't even name them all. And so there were protests then, and there were college students who were protesting. We didn't see the same level of, it wasn't quite the powder keg that things that erupted in this situation. But, you know, it happens and it keeps happening. And as I was working on the book, I met some people in Montgomery, Alabama I didn't know. I went to the neighborhood I used to live in as a little girl, and there were signs on people's lawns that said, justice for Greg Gunn. Greg Gunn was a black man who was walking down the street one night in 2016, and a white police officer stopped him. There was an exchange, an encounter of some kind, and the officer ended up tasing him, chasing him, beating him, and shooting him to death. That didn't get adjudicated until finally 2019. There were about eight different judges. Some of them were found not fit to handle the case. Some recused themselves. Eventually, the white police officer's lawyers asked for the trial to be moved. They had a change of venue, and I thought the white officer's legal defense team thought that would be better for him. The case got tried in a rural town in Alabama, and a jury of mostly white people found the white police officer guilty, but not of first-degree murder. It was of a lesser charge of manslaughter, but it was kind of a surprising verdict for a place in the Deep South, and very unexpected. And as I ended the book, it gave me kind of a glimmer of hope. And now this.
What would you say to the young people out there who say they're happy that the charges have been amended, and but that this isn't finished and they will stay out there? What would you say to them to encourage them to stay strong and keep fighting for the justice they believe in?
I think they should stay out there, and they should continue to march, and they should ignore the president calling for the military to come in and confront them. If they can keep their demonstration peaceful to get their points across, they are understanding that the looting and the setting things on fire isn't the answer, though. I had a conversation with a young man who went down to Lafayette Park across from the White House, and he says he's been involved in peaceful demonstrating, but that he has talked to some of the people who were doing the looting. What they were saying was that they felt that looting these big stores, it's like their way of getting back reparations that they feel that they pay or do. I don't understand that, but I think they should continue. I think, you know, you need more and better dialogue between the races, and what I'm seeing that's different now from what I saw in earlier demonstrations back in the 60s and the 70s is that the protesters seem to be largely a more diverse group, more in black and white people together. But what's more important than anything else now is getting people out to vote. Younger people and some of the millennials have had a history of not thinking that voting is so important. But if you want to make fundamental change, you've got to change the leadership at the top, and you've just got to get to the polls and make sure you vote so you can make a difference.
VOA's Lori London speaking with Karen Gray Houston, journalist and author of the book Daughter of the Boycott.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Japanese public broadcaster NHK apologized Tuesday and deleted from its Twitter account an animated video aimed at explaining the background behind U.S. protests for police reform, but which instead sparked online outrage for its depiction of African Americans. All the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. I'm Ira Melman. American protesters are calling for defunding or abolishing police forces in order to stop police brutality and racism. Already, the Minneapolis City Council has announced plans to disband its police department. For more on what is behind the call to defund the police, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with Scott Hechinger, who was a public defense attorney in New York City for close to a decade and now directs Zealous. That is an advocacy organization that works with defense lawyers and the communities they serve. Here is part of their conversation.
I think a lot of people, maybe most people, even might think the idea of any city, let alone a major one, existing without a police force. And they might think about this as shocking. But as a public defender for close to a decade and seeing what I've seen, I think it's far more shocking that we've continued to allow our governments to invest billions annually in what has been a failed strategy that undermines public health, that fails to solve crime, that inflicts generational, emotional, and physical violence on predominantly Black and brown communities. And on top of that, doesn't even make communities safer. The reality is that police are just not very good at doing what we want them to do, which is solve crime. We've tried reforming police. 2014 through 2016, we went through a whole round of reforms that are continuing to today. Things like body cameras, calling for police accountability, calling for more training, the Department of Justice coming into states and investigating and overseeing local police forces. And these reforms just don't work. I think we need, and I think more people are starting to realize, that we need a page one rewrite. There's fear about what that looks like, but people are not being kept safe now. I think the downside and the risk would just be keeping the status quo.
Looking at some of your personal experiences, why do you think that it is necessary to defund or even get rid of police departments?
I think of the young 19-year-old boy in court who I was representing, literal tears in his eyes, scared to go to his corner store to pick up a sandwich for fear of being harassed by those same police again, stopped and frisked. I think about all those black eyes, scratch marks, broken bones, ripped clothes and bruises, and the lies that police over and over again tell to justify their excessive use of force. I think about every single one of the thousands of people I met, and the majority of people who are coming through the system, arrested for things that arise out of substance abuse disorder, from poverty, from homelessness, from mental health issues, who would have been better served in communities better helped if better addiction and mental health services, poverty alleviation, affordable housing existed instead of the billions spent to policing public health issues. The bottom line is what I have seen and what I've heard and what my colleagues have seen and heard and experienced with the people we represent, it's become clear that American policing is just broken beyond repair.
Scott Hechinger, who now directs Zealous, an advocacy organization that works with defense lawyers and the communities they serve, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Scientists the world over are looking for a vaccine that protects against COVID-19. Others are searching for a treatment to knock out the virus until a vaccine is available. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that researchers in Sweden are optimistic about their work on a treatment that could slow the progression of the disease and ease the symptoms and save lives.
Tyson may become the world's most famous alpaca. Researchers from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm have immunized him with coronavirus proteins and isolated tiny antibodies known as nanobodies in his blood. Antibodies are proteins that are produced by your immune system when it senses the body has been infected with a virus or another foreign body. The proteins then try to kill it off. Nanobodies are far smaller than the antibodies humans produce, and nanobodies bind to the same part of the virus that human antibodies do. Gerald McKinnery is one of the scientists working on this project.
So these are the antibodies that we took from the alpaca's blood cells, and we can see that those antibodies are bound right on the surface, exactly at the point that the viral protein needs to get into cells. And so this gives us a structural understanding of how these antibodies work to stop the infection.
McKinnery says the results will be published in a few months. The work could lead to a drug that would help reduce the amount of virus in a patient's blood while the immune system develops its own response to the infection.
All the evidence would suggest that it will work very well in humans, but it's a very complex system, so we look forward to getting to do those experiments.
A vaccine could take years to develop, which is why the scientists at the Karolinska Institute focused on developing a treatment. It could help stop the pandemic while a vaccine is being developed that offers long-term immunity. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
North Korea said on Tuesday it will sever hotlines with South Korea as the first step towards shutting down all contact with Seoul. That according to the state news agency KCNA. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
For several days, North Korea has lashed out at South Korea, threatening to close a liaison office and other projects if the South does not stop defectors from sending leaflets and other material into the North. And the abrupt move will come as soon as noon on Tuesday, when the North will close lines of communication at both an inter-Korean liaison office and hotlines between the two militaries and presidential offices. On Tuesday morning, North Korean officials did not answer a routine daily call to the liaison office, nor calls on military hotlines, Yonhap News Agency reported. The decision to cut communications marks a setback in efforts to try and persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program in exchange for relief on tough international sanctions. The two Koreas remain technically at war because the 1950 to 1953 Korean War ended with an armistice rather than a peace treaty.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. You're listening to VOA Asia. Australia's spy chief is warning of a surge in espionage, extremist propaganda, and cybercrime during the COVID crisis. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
COVID-19 has given hackers, criminals, and terrorists a world of opportunity to exploit Australians online during lockdowns. In a podcast with the Institute of Public Administration Australia, a non-partisan research body, ASIO Chief Mike Burgess said the coronavirus pandemic has provided opportunities for criminals and extremists.
We've seen more people at home, and as they're at home, they're online, and we've seen increased chatter in the online world when it comes to the spread of extremist ideology, attempting to radicalise people. So we've seen more of that, just as we've seen more criminal behaviour online, cybercrime, which is well reported by other agencies.
Burgess also criticized tech companies for resisting requests by security agencies to access information in cyberspace. Analysts say his comments are a strong hint that Australia's intelligence community wants new powers to access end-to-end encrypted content. It's a move described by civil liberties campaigners as a power grab. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Papaboon, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please be careful, stay safe, and enjoy your day.